The House takes another crack at aid for Israel and Ukraine. A meltdown at NPR, and the fallout from Iran's attack on Israel settles over the political landscape. All this and more on today's episode of The Editors. I'm Noah Rothman. Rich is out today, but in his absence, we are joined by senior writer Charles C.W. Cook, senior writer Michael Brendan Doherty, you might know him as MBD, and staff writer Madeline Maddie Kearns. You're, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Patriot Voices and Donors Trust. More on them a little later on. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So the dust continues to settle following Iran's decision to make good on its threat to execute a direct attack on Israel in response to an Israeli airstrike inside Syria that killed two IRGC commanders, one of whom was implicated in the planning of the October 7th massacre. Israel continues to contemplate its response to that attack, one which consisted of over 350 drones and rockets executed by the regime itself, not its proxies. But not all of Iran's Western allies seem to be on board. President Joe Biden reportedly told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to take the win and stand down. British Defense Minister David Cameron has agreed and joined him. He said, quote, "I think this is time to think with the head as well as the heart and be smart as well as tough," which is translated roughly as just don't do anything, Israel. We really don't want to see you do too much to put us in a bad position. And then there was this unnamed person in Politico who said something absolutely manic. And the U.S. official said that because there was the whole point of this effort, the United States, UK, France, and Jordan, and Saudi Arabia joining in to intercept all this ordnance, that it was the whole point of it was that Israel wouldn't feel, quote, compelled to come back with another overwhelming response, and we can de-escalate and be done. That's obviously crazy. Michael, what do you make of the rationalizations on display here from the Western powers? The notion here that because some of these missiles penetrated Israeli airspace, if one of those weapons had a weapon of mass destruction on it, the entire raison d'etre of the Jewish state preserving Jewish life would be imperiled. It cannot allow that, but the Western powers seem inclined to compel it to do so. And the worst part of it, Michael, is they trot out this nonsense conception that Israel risks squandering the goodwill that it has accrued by taking it on the chin and not responding. Should Israel adopt this Jesus-like posture and offer the other cheek to the Islamic Republic?
Did you just ask me if the Jews should convert?
mixed religious metaphor, but throwing it out there.
So, listen, Israel's damned if they do, damned if they don't, as far as international opinion is concerned. Why is that? Again, I've referred in the past to like the mystery of the standards that are applied to Israel. Israel obviously deserves to retaliate and to try to reestablish deterrence. How it does so, of course, matters a great deal. I know that I understand the rest of the world's response. You know, the diplomatic response is basically, please God, not a general regional war in the Middle East. Like, we do not want to see all the Shia and Sunni forces unleashed on each other and the Shiite ones also on Israel.
And we have no indication Israel wants that either.
It's calibrated
since 10/7 to avoid that.
Exactly. And I've congratulated Israel on walking a very tight and difficult tightrope in its response. And I do get the sense that Israel would like to go at Hezbollah and basically as an extension of the threat that they faced on 10/7, which is like, we cannot have this kind of a militant threat just sitting on our border waiting for an opportunity to break in. beyond that, I mean, there's a lot I don't know. I mean, we had in the initial days lots of weird reporting about how Iran had kind of, you know, sent word that this attack was coming through Turkey or through Saudi, and Saudis warned the Americans, and the Americans started saying, okay, but no more than this. And I have no idea what to make of those reports or how those that reporting will develop in the coming weeks. And there's a lot I don't know about Iran right now. I feel like it is a black box as far as what are their long-term intentions? Oh, you know, how stable is this regime? How unstable is it? Who is in a position to govern if not Iran, if not this regime? You know, I think that's an important question to ask if Israel is going to take a really dramatic step. You know, we took a very dramatic step in Iraq, and it turned out that Iran was the biggest influence in post-war Iraq. And that was a problem. So I don't know. I think Israel has been very calculated and very careful in its response. I think it may use this time when it supposedly has a little more international goodwill to complete the job in Rafah, and then come up with a plan for Iran in the future. Remember, like, Israel's been criticized sometimes for moving too slow to respond, when I think it's just been deliberate and deliberative.
Yeah, especially by Israelis. And we're getting some news from the administration, not attributable to any sources, but that the Biden administration, after spending the last several weeks saying, don't go into Rafah. If you do go into Rafah, don't move the people. If you don't move the people, you got to protect the people somehow, doing everything they can to prevent this. And then all of a sudden they're saying, well, don't hit Iran, but you can go into Rafah.
Yeah.
Which is particularly craven. Madeline, predictably, the response to Israel's targeting by this massive Iranian attack from the American left has been to blame Israel. The country saw mass demonstrations over the week with protesters blocking bridges, thoroughfares, and airports from coast to coast, some of them burning American flags while brandishing Hezbollah regalia and wearing Hamas paraphernalia. I think it's fair to say at this point that if you're putting on all this stuff that is associated with terrorist groups that kill Americans, you're pro-terrorism. You're not anti-Israel. So this would be, in my view, a great opportunity for Democrats with some spine to have the chance to publicly, maybe not through statements or surrogates, but even directly, distance themselves from this very unsympathetic constituency. It seems that the only people who are really on board with this thing, this kind of behavior, are folks like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. It doesn't speak for the Democratic Party, but they won't take this opportunity, will they?
No, and you're right to say that I think Biden really has his head in the sand with this, and he wants the problem to go away. He wants Israel to take the win, quote unquote. You know, with World War II and the evacuation of Dunkirk, we're reminded that victories are not achieved through mass evacuations. Iran and Hezbollah, between them, have cleared out northern Israel. This is Israel in a fight for its own existence. So yes, we can absolutely say that the performances of Israeli and its allies' drones and air defenses were, of course, commendable, but that's not really enough. And also, Jim points out in the corner that roughly 50% of the ballistic missiles fired by Iran failed to launch or crashed before even reaching their target. So we can't be totally confident in attributing the success of this defense, and it was a successful defense, on the air defense measures Israel has in place. As Michael says, it's very difficult because on the one hand, Israel does have this unique problem where they have to be dealing with their allies' expectations, unreasonable expectations really, and contending with the threats as they are in the Middle East. And you know, they're naturally going to be looking at getting on the offensive here, not just waiting to be the target of these attacks. They're going to be looking for oil and gas operations and taking out Iranian air defenses, maybe even looking to weapons scientists and whether they can be a target. You know, the U.S.'s response is to emphasize the economic tools to counter Iran's activity. You had Janet Yellen basically coming out saying that. Well, that's fine for the US to say. In fact, it's a bit rich for them to say, given their release last September of $6 billion in Iranian oil revenue, which hasn't exactly helped this situation. But that's just not enough. Israel cannot take the win. It wasn't a win. It was a successful defense measure, and it can't stop there. They're in a fight for their survival.
Charlie, the Israeli government is starting to prepare the information space ahead of what I expect will be a retaliation. It's putting a lot out there. Probably a lot of it is misdirection. It might strike Iranian proxies outside Israeli territory. It might strike Iranian military facilities, but in a calibrated way to communicate de-escalatory intent. It might even strike Iranian nuclear facilities, which probably has to happen eventually, but I don't think it can happen without American logistical support for things like mid-air refueling operations, etc. The old conceptions of deterrence here, if Iran did develop a fissionable device, a deliverable fissionable device, I don't think really apply. We do have to go back to the old 9/11 mentality to a certain degree, the Cheney 1% rule, which maintained that if there is the prospect that a power like Iran can transfer these weapons to terrorist actors, we can't take that risk. The 10/7 attack, which was executed by Hamas, which is an Iranian proxy force armed and supported by Iran and directed to a certain degree by Iran, it demonstrated on 10/7 that it has the will to execute a genocidal attack on Israelis and target Americans, by the way, kill Americans. Three Americans died as a result of these operations, Iran-directed operations. And 4/14, Saturday night, demonstrated that it has the means to act on its intent. This is very hard to contemplate, the notion that it could strike these nuclear facilities like Fordo, for example, and successfully destroy them. We don't know if it even has that capability, but nevertheless, the alternative is equally difficult to contemplate. Should the United States be prepared to support an operation if Israel wants to execute it to take out Iranian nuclear facilities?
Yes, well, you say it's hard to contemplate. Of course, back when the Iran deal was being negotiated in, was it 2015? I grew tired of reading its advocates suggesting that anybody who thought it was a bad idea was in favor of war. As if the Iranian regime and its behavior are entirely contingent upon American attitudes. As if Iran has no agency. I think it's important here to go back to first principles. I think much of the rhetoric that you outlined at the beginning of this segment is rooted in an outright belief, or in some cases a suspicion, that Israel is illegitimate. I don't think there's any other circumstance in which a nation would be subject to two attacks now, one courtesy of Hamas, the other courtesy of Iran, and yield the international response that you adumbrated. This was the way it was discussed back in the mid-2000s as well. And the defenders of Israel would say, look, imagine if it were Rhode Island. Or imagine if it were Cambridgeshire. What would you think? Now, the obvious answer to that is you would think, well, the United States in the case of Rhode Island, or Britain in the case of Cambridgeshire, has to respond. It would not be the fault of those nations if there were a broader conflagration, unless you think Rhode Island was stolen or you think Cambridge is illegitimate. That's what's happening here. I understand the broader abhorrence of war. I share it. I don't want a Middle Eastern war either. But I just see over and over again the blame being put in the wrong place. Israel has to calm down. Israel has to use its head rather than its heart. What does that mean? Its head rather than its heart. We are how many months now shy of the attack on October 7th? five, six, seven?
Six and
a half. It's hardly as if Israel jumped within seconds with the blood pumping. It's hardly as if a mob stormed into Gaza or started running towards Iran. The head has been engaged here. I don't understand the rhetoric. The head has been engaged. If David Cameron and co. think that there is a better way for Israel to proceed, then it is incumbent upon those people to outline it without these vague statements that insinuate what I think has not been proven. Now, the Iran question is difficult, I grant. But the nature of Iran should not be difficult to comprehend. We know what Iran is. We know what Iran does. We know with whom Iran is allied. And this should give us another indication of what it is that they are hoping to achieve in the region. So I would just like to see a little bit more concrete argument here and less hand-waving, less blame, less unique standards being applied, as they seemingly always are.
All right, so exit question briefly. We all pretty much think Israel's going to respond directly, but does it respond directly inside Iranian territory at the risk of being condemned by the Biden administration, which I'm pretty sure would happen? Michael.
My bet is on a massive retaliation against Iranian proxy Hezbollah at some point, and covert retaliation inside Iran, with maybe some kind of demonstrative, other demonstrative element. But I just think Israel has done a fantastic job historically defending its interests by covertly, committing sabotage and subterfuge against the Iranian nuclear program. And I don't know why you would change that playbook.
Interesting. Madeline?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that they're going to pursue their own interests and not worry too much about angering the Americans. That's certainly been their approach so far, and that was their approach in the initial targets that led to this Iranian attack.
Charlie?
Well, let me ask you this, Noah, in response. Do you think that if Israel engaged in a direct attack and there were consequences for that from Iran, that the Americans, and perhaps the British and others, would say, you know what, you're now on your own?
No, they wouldn't say you're on your own. My biggest question mark here is if Israel responds in a way that triggers Iran to activate Hezbollah rain some of those 30,000 rockets that are in its possession down on Israel, whether the Biden administration would follow through with the implicit threat in the location of U.S. forces off the coast of the Levant. Would we engage directly with Hezbollah? Because we have a deterrent posture, and if deterrence breaks down, we have to engage. I think the Biden administration would be loath to pursue that. I don't think they'd have much of a choice.
Right.
So, it's one of those big question marks, and that's why I don't know whether Israel's response will be big enough to risk that.
Right, but I think Israel has an enormous amount of leeway here. I think that Israel's approach historically has been that it has to be able to rely on itself, and that it will defend itself when it needs to, and that it wants to keep its alliance with the United States because it needs that alliance. And as such, I think that Israel is going to do what it needs to do right up to the point at which it seriously believes that it is risking American aid and support. And I don't think that it is likely to risk that support, even with a direct response. Now, there are actions it could take right out of the bleeding edge that would risk that support. But when push comes to shove, unless you think that the Americans are really on the verge, beyond rhetoric, of actually making it materially difficult for Israel to exist and fight back against its many enemies, then I think it's going to use the latitude that it has here and hit Iran directly.
Well, we will find out soon enough. But in the meantime, let's take a moment to hear from our first sponsor of the day, Donors Trust, the tax-friendly way to preserve your charitable giving. In times of crisis, those with a giving spirit and a desire to build up civil society find ways to help. And that's when it's good to have a charitable resource ready to deploy where they're needed most. Donors Trust offers donor-advised funds or giving accounts. You can use these funds as your own charitable investment account and manage your charitable giving in a way that's smart, tax-advantaged, and private. Donors Trust clients are using their funds to support charities in their local communities and think tanks preserving civil liberties, among other important things. Now is the time to take a closer look at Donors Trust and join their community of liberty-minded donors by opening a donor-advised fund. Go to donorstrust.org/editors for our The Ultimate Survival Guide to Charitable Giving and learn how a donor-advised fund can preserve your ability to give charitably. That's donorstrust.org/editors. So House Speaker Mike Johnson spent the last couple of weeks retailing his intention to try passing some much-needed aid to America's overseas allies, including Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine. He's taken a bunch of heat for his plan from some of the more skeptical members of his conference, but he's out there striking while the iron's hot. And the plan, as I understand it, is to move four separate bills, breaking the bills up to support U.S. partners abroad and revitalize the American defense industrial base. Whether it's a Taiwan bill, an Israel bill, a Ukraine bill, and then a fourth bill, which will include a variety of Republican priorities, including H.R. 2, a border security bill, and the TikTok divestiture initiative, which already passed the House. So it's kind of weird there. But those who are opposed to these bills are up in arms. They're trying to scuttle the effort. They're making big theatrical displays of their hostility, including MTG and Tom Massey, who have said that if this goes through, if Mike Johnson does this, they're going to push a motion to vacate, try to force him out of the speakership. And there's some speculation that Johnson wouldn't have done this at all if he didn't get some assurances from Democrats that they would not support the ouster of him from the speakership as they did Kevin McCarthy. But Charlie, the Biden White House came out in support of Johnson's plan, which is never a good sign if you're a Republican. There are lots of very vocal Republicans against this aid, and the Wall Street Journal reported a couple of weeks ago that upwards of 20 Democratic House members are against the Israel portion. So if you've been reading the tea leaves for months, you know, the prospects for this thing should be good because the majority supports it, and probably a majority of the minority supports it. So will these bills pass, in your estimation, and will that give pause to the activists on the other side of this equation who presume to speak for the vast majority of the silent majority in this country that opposes all foreign intervention and support for foreign intervention?
Before I augur whether or not the bills will pass, I'd like to praise Speaker Johnson, who I think last night, certainly I saw the clip last night, effectively said at a press conference that he was done catering to the fringe, that he was not going to spend his time worrying about one or two members using the power they negotiated to oust him, that he had a job to do, a role to play, a place within the system, that he had his own views as to how he ought to use that, but that he also had to accept the views of the House as a whole, and that if he was kicked out as a result of this, so be it. I saw this clip being posted by people on the left who were pleased by it, but said they don't quite trust him. I, of course, don't know him, and this is speculation, but watching his body language and his eyes, I did trust him. I think he meant it. I think in concert that he may be confident that he can pull it off. Either he really has reached the end of his tether and he has decided to do what he believes to be right, hang the consequences, or he has an inkling that the bills are going to pass, that there is sufficient support, that the bluster from the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene will not come to fruition, and that he will, if it comes to it, be saved by the Democrats. So I am heartened to see the Speaker standing up for his role as the head of the House, who has responsibility for its business for both parties, in effect. And I was heartened to see the confidence with which Speaker Johnson said these things. So yes, I think that these bills are going to pass, and I think a statement will be made as a result.
So Michael, stop me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but I think you're skeptical of the structure of this proposal, not just the Ukraine side of it broadly, particularly the presidential drawdown authority provisions that allow Joe Biden and his successors to tailor the disbursement of U.S. material and financial support per their reading of the strategic financial landscape. Am I right there? And if so, elaborate on your disquiet.
The drawdown authority bothers me in the sense that if the intention is to give, is that there's a kind of hide the ball aspect where the drawdown authority cuts against the part of the bill that's being advertised as replenishment of U.S. war material, right? Which is that the drawdown affects literally everything that is being used for replenishing our stocks of weapons. The drawdown can apply to all of that. Now, of course, you know, in some ways you could argue this is a concession to the skeptics because it allows perhaps, if Donald Trump is elected, to stop the drawdown and allow a replenishment of U.S. resources to actually happen. I'm skeptical on that side. As everyone knows, I'm skeptical of our long-term project of making Ukraine dependent on us and the West and its institutions and incorporating it into them, which this war assistance implies we intend to do long-term. And I'm also curious, like, do hawks really think this is enough? I mean, we're after a year in which we gave over $100 billion in aid to Ukraine for a counteroffensive. We made all sorts of extraordinary efforts to get donations of weapons from South Korea, from all sorts of other allies, and the counteroffensive failed. And now we're sending much less, $60 billion in weapons. There's much less, you know, donor-type material available to send, although some are sending. I mean, I would argue, like, Germany is depleting necessary stocks itself with some of the tanks it's sending. But do hawks expect this to work? Or, I mean, I really wonder why there isn't more debate about saying, if we're going to give you aid to Ukraine, it should be focused on more defensive weapons rather than offensive ones aimed at recapturing territory, rather than defensive measures to stop them from continuing to lose territory. I think they desperately need, like, concrete. I'm not sure what they can accomplish with tanks and attackums against what they're facing, at least at this level. I mean, I would think if you're a hawk, you would want, you know, quadruple the amount, although it just may not be available and it may not be possible given our industrial supply constraints. So for all those reasons.
Well, I am a hawk, and I do want more as much as possible, and I'll take whatever offensive weapons they can provide. The defensive phase of this war is behind us. And I will say, certainly share your concerns, Michael, with the constraints on the defense industrial base, not just for Ukraine's sake, but Taiwan, Israel, and our own, if we can't survive.
I mean, I think we agree on that, absolutely. But I mean, Ukraine.
But I will add briefly, not to interrupt you, because I do want you to get the final word on this, but there is a source of frustration for me, and not your argument necessarily, but the argument of the restrainers who, at the outset of these conflicts, say we can't intervene because it's not in our domestic interest to do so. And after a prolonged delay, they say we can't intervene anymore because the strategic situation has deteriorated to the point that it doesn't advantage us anymore. Well, that's the effect of your advocacy. That drives me nuts.
This is sort of, listen, if I tell you, you can't eat you can't finish the 40 pizza challenge at the pizzeria around the corner, and then you go and try to eat it, and then you're going to blame me when you're 20 pizzas in and feeling sick. I mean, it's not my fault. I mean, I have no doubt there's going to be a stab in the back narrative that who lost Ukraine? It was the skeptics. If only we believed harder. But I just don't think that's true. And it doesn't fit with the analysis before the war, which was essentially right. It just right in the, it was just wrong in the short term, right? I mean, it was right that Russia would likely prevail in some kind of military conflict. I still don't think Russia will try to swallow all of Ukraine, but I do think Ukraine, could, possibly benefit from shifting to a more defensive strategy, because currently Russia is making very slow progress at gobbling up more territory, which is, obviously setting itself up for either taking that territory long term or squeezing more political concessions out of what remains of Ukraine in the end of this war.
So, Madeline, Michael's not wrong. Ukraine is enjoying real successes on the Black Sea and in long range attacks on Russian facilities deep inside the Federation, to the consternation of the administration, the Biden administration, apparently. But the battlefield situation is going poorly for Ukraine. Even the speediest rush of arms to Kiev won't change the battlefield conditions anytime soon, though they might in the long term, they won't in the near term. And that will probably give a big shot in the arm to skeptics of this cause, whose hearts may be hardened at this point anyway, even if there was a condition on the battlefield that shifted in the direction of Kiev. Is there any indication that the public is persuadable when it comes to their outlook towards this conflict, the conflict in Israel? Are partisans just locked into their positions on these two respective conflicts?
I think it's hard for people to imagine what it would actually mean for Russians to control this enormous new border with NATO. I mean, that's basically what's going to happen if Putin is successful with Ukraine. And that really does completely change the security for not just NATO and European countries, but it would have serious big consequences for the United States as well. I think people just have a kind of lack of imagination for this. And, we're arguing about money and of course there's concerns with that. And I think, Mike Johnson has done his absolute best here to placate both sides, both the right and left flank who are unhappy with the way things have been negotiated so far. So he's got measures in there to ensure funds are spent correctly, and a requirement that Ukraine enter into a loan agreement to repay economic assistance funds. And then the Israel portion of the bill as well contains about $9.5 billion in humanitarian aid to both Ukraine and Gaza. Which is obviously a big concern for the left. But to go back to this point, there's more at stake here than just Mike Johnson's speakership. And do the public get that? I mean, naturally, people focus more on domestic issues, but I think that the way things are with these various conflicts has pushed foreign policy to certainly more to the top of people's minds than it would usually be. Mike Johnson's done his best, and I think this is really politically the best thing that he could have achieved.
All right. So in Rich's honor, exit question, double barreling it. we're leaving the GOP.
Created a monster.
That's I'm going to get a pat on the head for this one. I can anticipate it now. So we're leaving the GOP priorities bill aside, the fourth bill with the border stuff, the TikTok stuff, just the three foreign aid bills, the defense industrial base bills. They will pass the House and the Senate and be signed by the president. And will Mike Johnson survive what Matt Gaetz has already called his abject surrender and their intention to oust him from the speakership? Charlie.
I think that Mike Johnson will survive, and I think the bill will pass.
Michael.
I think the bills will pass. I think Mike Johnson's speakership will come under tremendous threat, and it may only survive with, you know, 25 votes or something like that, and another deal. I don't know. I think he'll be in trouble, but there really is not an endless sent. There's not an endless number of Mike Johnsons that the GOP can just cycle through. I mean, at some point, if they even tried to do that, one or two more a few more members would quit, and the Democrats would have the majority in short order.
Yeah, probably. Madeline.
Yes and yes, although Johnson is now obviously dependent on Democratic support, which is not a good place to be in. And it's the same struggle that McCarthy had before him. But ultimately, he's not going to win the respect of the right flank, no matter what he does. So he might as well do what he's doing.
Yeah, I'm double barreling the yeses. Yes, yes. And I also think that if the motion to vacate comes down to, for example, just MTG and Tom Massey voting against his speakership, the narrative that will be retailed that Mike Johnson's speakership was saved by Democrats, it'll be attempted, but I don't think it will have many takers. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor of the day, Patriot Voices. Here's a simple thought. Parents matter. After all, who knows what's better for children, their parents or bureaucrats? Do you know what's best for your child, or do bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. have your child's best interest at heart? The answer is obvious. Parents matter. Right now, Congress is advancing a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. This bill would strip parents of their decision-making authority. If bureaucrats at the Federal Trade Commission decide that a Christian video or a homeschooling site is dangerous or unscientific, your family won't be able to access that material on the internet. Kids will be banned from seeing content online that the government deems dangerous. But the government's definition of what poses a threat to your child very likely is not your definition. If you believe parents matter, join Patriot Voices in opposing this takeover of parents' authority. Go to patriotvoices.com for more information to take action. Again, that's patriotvoices.com, because parents matter. So it's been a while since we had a feel-good story as rich and rewarding as the meltdown at NPR. On April 9th, Barry Weiss's very good outfit, the Free Press, published a piece authored by longtime NPR journalist Yuri Berliner, who criticized his employer for leaning into its progressive bias in a couple of stories, the Russia probe into Donald Trump in 2016, the Hunter Biden laptop, among others. Generally, the indictment was Donald Trump's presidency compelled NPR to abandon, abdicate its journalistic responsibilities. It's not an earth-shattering revelation that NPR leans into its liberal biases, but it made a big splash, and Berliner was subsequently suspended for his sin, and yesterday he resigned in protest. So, Madeline, I'd like you to comment on the Berliner scandal and what it says about NPR, but we just can't do this story justice without remarking on the very best part of it, which is the fact that his expose, Berliner's expose, occasioned this deep dive from conservative media outlets into the public profile of NPR's new CEO, Catherine Marr. And her public comments and her Twitter profile and her TED Talks, she has this uncanny valley aspect to her, of this affluent, highly educated, female progressive stereotype. She comes off as a composite character in this ham-fisted parody of what a progressive believes. And I've been assured that she is, in fact, a flesh and blood person. But perhaps, Madeline, you have some inside information that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, so I think it was our colleague Jeff Blair who pointed out that this piece by this NPR senior editor, at the very end of this free press essay, he sort of leaves breadcrumbs pointing to Catherine Mayer, and he did it in actually quite a subtle way. He said, you know, sort of, I wish her all the best, but she, you know, she doesn't have a news background, hint, hint. And you had Chris Ruffo and others dig into this, and what they found was just really, as you say, almost a caricature. So saying that Hillary Clinton, she wishes that she wouldn't use the language of boy and girl because it's a raising language for non-binary people. Looting is counterproductive, but it's hard to be mad about protests not prioritizing the private property of a system of oppression founded on treating people's ancestors as private property, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so she's pretty far out there. I mean, I think actually I shared your sense, Noah, of reading this and thinking, is any of this really news? It's interesting sometimes in media what really takes hold and causes a splash. But I think one aspect of this that I maybe didn't appreciate, partly perhaps because I'm not American, is I didn't realize actually the degree to which NPR receives public money. So we highlight this in our editorial that NPR like claims that it's 1% that it gets in direct federal funds, but actually it's significantly more than that when you consider indirect revenue. And this reminds me of the debate we have in the UK about the BBC. So the BBC, because it's taxpayer funded, it's required to be impartial. It's required to show a range of views. And naturally, over time, what's happened is it hires the same demographic of people, which is mostly white middle class liberals from elite universities, and they all have the identical same worldview, and it starts to trickle into BBC reporting. So, for example, with the transgender debate, that's been something that a lot of people have complained about, the way it's covered that, even hiring gender identity diversity reporters or whatever. So it's a similar thing. Look, you can't have it both ways. If you want to be a left-wing, crazy, progressive outfit, then go at it, but stop taking taxpayer money.
Charlie, my wife and I had a blast with this Mar story. We sat down, you know, while I was making dinner, and we were going back and forth over her statements, which are objectively hilarious, and her background from her time in these wealthy schools growing up and studying Arabic and going to UNICEF, and then her ascension to CEO of Wikimedia in her mid-30s. It led a lot of the people, the online types, to speculate that she's an elaborate intelligence operation. And I'm like, no, obviously, it can't be that. But then the more I was reading about it, the more I was like, okay, well, possibly. can't really rule it out, can you? Because she's just so inauthentic.
Well, I don't think she's inauthentic. I think she is for real. I wrote about this yesterday in response to Jeff Blair's piece, in which he said the empathetic take was to assume it was a performance. I don't think it is. I think that's why it's creepy. We can all tell a performer. You can sense it. Twitter is full of performers who don't know necessarily that their performance is obvious, but who are acting transparently. I don't think she is. She is the same whether she's bashing off a tweet in the middle of a TV show she's watching or trying to be serious. I think that she is pure. I think she is utterly unself-aware. I think she is myopic. I think she routinely, as might a robot, filters all of her experiences through the ideology that she's picked up. I think she is NPR. I think she should be fused to it, or possibly should marry it. The criticisms that Yuri Berliner made were correct. The broader criticisms of NPR that conservatives have made for a long time are also correct. The problem with NPR being publicly funded is real. The one area in which I disagree, I think, with the standard conservative response to this, is that I do not share any horror or even irritation whatsoever at the news that Yuri Berliner was fired. Of course he was fired. He stood up and criticized his employer in no uncertain terms. He said it was not fit for purpose. He implicitly and explicitly slammed all of his colleagues. Now, I'm glad he did it. I think he should be praised for having done it. But the argument that his being suspended and then resigning demonstrates the intolerance of NPR misses the point. The intolerance of NPR is ideological, it's political. NPR is not representative of the public it putatively serves. But if you do what Yuri Berliner did anywhere, you will be and ought to be fired. Dan Foster taught me this old Spanish proverb, take what you want, but pay for it. Yuri Berliner took what he wanted. I'm glad he did. He's paid for it. You couldn't do that at National Review. You couldn't do that at The Nation. You couldn't do that at The New York Times. There is a very big difference between standing up and saying, I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, and then being fired by NPR for that, and saying, you know what? NPR is a disaster. Here are all of the problems with the people I work with and the people who pay my salary. So I don't think it's a problem that he was pushed out. I think the problem is what he highlighted. And I am grateful that he did so. And I think perhaps for the first time in a long time, there is some opportunity here, if not to pull public funding from NPR, to at least demand some reform, because the juxtaposition between all of the arguments that Yuri Berliner made and then this absurd Catherine Ma person who's almost standing outside with a sign saying, yes, we are what they say we are, is delicious.
So, Michael, Charlie's characteristically charitable and judicious approach to this issue notwithstanding, I'm unconvinced. I think NPR spun a pretty mundane bit of dissent into a multi-day controversy that's now an outright scandal. They've been on the back foot since this dropped, and they've handled it incredibly poorly, in my view. It's in part because of the audience capture phenomenon that has really hamstrung NPR. They've cultivated this audience that regards Mara's very patronizing and at times otherworldly conception of her environment as normal and disregards Berliner's intellectual curiosity as outmoded, if not worse. And I really feel like this is the kiss of death for a news organization that intends to have a broad audience, and especially one that depends on taxpayer funds. Maybe not now, but on this trajectory, NPR will be defunded. This is my view. And I think this could be a turning point for NPR if they didn't take steps to address very legitimate public concerns. And I don't think they will. Am I wrong? Will the institution correct course here? Or are they on a doomed trajectory?
I think they're on a doomed trajectory. I'd actually almost characterize it as the opposite of audience capture in some ways. Yes, NPR has a liberal audience that it's overserved. I mean, personally, I would love to have an NPR that served me. I like a lot of non-commercial broadcast offerings when they are offering what they promise to offer, right? I mean, personally, I would just junk the NPR part of the budget and ask BBC what we could pay for BBC Three and just take that and replace NPR with classical music chosen by Brits. Not being able to do that, though, I mean, I think the real problem is something Berliner identified in his essay, which is the emergence of affinity groups inside the institution. And I think this is something the New York Times has struggled with as well, where there's almost a kind of, quasi-legal civil rights pressure to push the content that they're producing into you know, extreme directions. And that, I think, is what's fatal to these institutions, is that they internally think like, oh, our Black employees are organizing, our tech employees are organizing to put, you know, pressure on us to be much more left-wing in what we actually produce, and much more narrow in who we produce it for. So that's I think, what has to be addressed at these institutions if they're going to cure themselves. But I don't know if they can do it.
I don't either, which is why I think that the doomed trajectory is where I'm placing my bets. With that, I'd like to take a moment to do a quick plug for NR Plus, our digital subscription service. It's your way around our metered paywall and your way to see 90% fewer ads when you sign up and log in. In addition, NR Plus subscribers are invited to comment on articles and blogs, and they get invites to exclusive calls and events with our writers, editors, and conservative newsmakers. It's a great deal all around, but most importantly, NR Plus is a crucial way to support our valuable journalism. If you're not already a member, please consider joining tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers by becoming a member of NR Plus today. And let's get to a couple of lighter items before we get out of here. Michael, you are going to see, is it your favorite artist? I don't want to speculate, but it might be your favorite artist.
I'm seeing Ben Folds tonight. He was one member of Ben Folds 5 in the 90s, who were absolutely my favorite band. And I have a legendary episode of Political Beats where I tell the story of sneaking backstage and getting them to write notes to a girl I liked at the time and who couldn't make it to the concert that night. And now she and I have three children and almost 15 years of marriage behind us. So yeah, I'm excited to see him tonight. I'm going to go with my wife. He's playing here locally. It should be a good show.
That's awesome. Sounds like a blast. Madeline, you're going to see the musical Merrily We Go.
In fact, I saw it last night.
Yeah,
so, and it was great. It's Stephen Sondheim. In fact, I've been looking for tickets for a long time. And this is one of the great advantages of living in New York City, is you can wait until there's a sale on expensive Broadway tickets or rush tickets, and you can just go on a Wednesday night. So that's what me and my husband did. And it was great. It had Daniel Radcliffe, who actually was excellent. I was not expecting him to be able to sing, but
I was about to ask, can he sing?
Yeah, he can sing. Oh. Certainly for, I mean, a lot of his role is sort of like talk singing.
Can he dance? Broadway trained, triple threat.
Well, the dancing, I mean, his character is sort of nerdy. So not really, but like it worked. So, but he was much better than I thought he was going to be. And then, the other two, in fact, one of the cast, was not there, and there was an understudy, Jonathan Groff. It was Evan Alexander Smith was there. Anyway, he was excellent. It was a great show. Highly recommend it. Although we had the benefit of not paying the full price. So, but still very good.
Very good, Charlie. You've been watching the show Manhunt.
I have, an Apple TV show. It's about the hunt for John Wilkes Booth after he assassinated Abraham Lincoln. Really, it could be called Stanton, because Stanton, the Secretary of War, is at the heart of it, as he was in real life. Everyone I know disliked the show, but I think it's really good. There's only one episode left. I think it's out on Friday. I thought it was excellent television. I thought the performances were good. That era is fascinating. It's a great story. Apple TV continues to impress me.
I only watched the first couple episodes of that show. I've got to get back into it. And I really enjoyed those first couple episodes. And Tobias Menzies' performance was fantastic. I haven't seen him in a leading role in a drama like that since he played Brutus in Rome, which is a masterpiece. So I really did enjoy it. For me, I'm heading out as soon as we wrap this up to fly down to Austin, Texas for a debate sponsored by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute against Michael Anton over the following resolution. Quote, America's defense of Ukraine is vital to upholding the liberal international order. If you want to watch it live yourself, that's tonight, Thursday, April 18th. you can do so. There's a live stream. You can register on ISI's website. That's isi.org/events. Or you can go to ISI's YouTube channel and look for the live tab. That's tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, April 18th at the University of Texas at Austin. And I hope to see you there. With that, let's get into some editor's picks. Madeline, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece by Audrey Fulwerk and Brittany Bernstein, How Ukraine is Dividing the House GOP and What It Means for November. I just really enjoy both of their reporting. Helps me stay in the loop, and it's really great on the ground stuff.
Charlie, what's your pick?
I am going to pick, as I often do, Andy McCarthy's ongoing explanation of the legal questions that roiled the nation. This time he is dealing with Trump's trial for so-called hush payments. He did so on his podcast, The McCarthy Report. He's done so on NRO. And I was fortunate enough to be able to ask him about it in person at one of the many NRI events that I've been traveling to and from in the last few weeks.
That's right. Welcome back, by the way. Michael, what's your pick?
My pick is Dominic Pino's The Bees Are Fine. Corner post, just pointing out that the scare campaign of several years ago about saving the bees from total extinction and saving ourselves turned out not to be so dire after all.
Yeah, so I want to put in a good word for Jeff Blair's very good piece. Yuri Berliner burned his bridges at NPR, then set the house ablaze. It's very well written and a very enjoyable read, but I also want to recommend our house editorial on a similar pretty much the same subject, but a similar subject. Defund NPR. It's an exquisitely written piece, and I couldn't agree more with the call to action. Go check it out. That's going to do it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this show without express written permission of the National Review magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast was produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Madeline. And thank you to the absent Rich Lowry. Also, thanks, of course, to our advertisers, Patriot Voices, and Donors Trust. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors, and we'll see you next time.